Today is February the 10th, 1971. We're on the campus of Oklahoma Christian College. I'm visiting today with Dr. Raymond Knight, who is the president of the Oklahoma County Historical Society and the president of the Will Rogers Memorial Commission, and who was a longtime educator in the state of Oklahoma and for many years was the principal of Will Rogers High School. We will talk with Dr. Knight about a number of things, including the Cherokee heritage of his grandmother, education in Oklahoma, as well as the history of the Blue Cross, with which Dr. Knight is also very familiar. To begin with, Dr. Knight, I wonder if you would take the mic and tell us a little about where you were born, when and who your parents were, and maybe just a little bit about your undergraduate schooling before college.
Well, I was born in Fort Scott, Kansas on January the 4th, 1903. And I did start to school at Fort Scott beginning, and then moved to Columbus, Kansas, where I lived with my parents and entered high school. And I did not complete high school at Columbus, but I moved 24 miles north to Girard, Kansas, where I entered high school and graduated there in 1920. And a year ago, I was invited back to this same high school to recognize the 50th year of my graduating from high school, and I was the speaker of the evening to some 20 of my former classmates in that class of 1920. Amazing thing about this was that I had to admit that it had been 50 years since I graduated from high school. That was a shocking realization. So that accounts for my elementary and high school years, and following that I entered school at Pittsburgh, Kansas, Kansas State Teachers College, and graduated there with an AB degree in 1925. And then I entered the teaching profession, coming to Oklahoma, became a high school principal at Hominy, Oklahoma, and stayed there until the fall of 1929, at which time I came to Tulsa, entered the Tulsa school system as an elementary principal, remained 3 years in that job, and then I was moved over to an elementary junior high school and remained 17 years there in Tulsa. And then I moved in 1950 to the Will Rogers High School, where I served as principal until I retired a little over a year ago.
I'm going to backtrack at this point, and we'll take a few subjects along the way because I want to take the education all in one when we talk about details in one package. I thought I would talk first about your grandmother and a little bit about her Cherokee heritage. Why don't you tell us a little who she was, and then recollect as best you can some of the stories and experiences that she has told you.
Well, one of the amazing stories that I have to tell about my grandmother, I was visiting with her while I was in high school at Girard, Kansas, and I thought I better ask her some questions about her early experiences in Oklahoma and to learn something about her background. So I was visiting with her, and she was 92 years of age at the time.
When was that?
This was in about 1919 or 20, about the time I graduated from high school. And she told me, I was particularly interested in the Civil War days, and she told me at that time she came to Oklahoma in 1848 from Kingston, Tennessee, is where she came from with her husband and family, and they settled at Blue Jacket, Oklahoma, and remained there for a great many years. And another thing about her, she told me that she had given birth to 18 children, and all but three lived to maturity. So my father had 11 brothers and three sisters. So this was quite remarkable to think that in those days that this was commonplace for women to have this size family. This showed that she was a remarkable woman. But the thing I asked her about the Civil War was what she remembered about the Civil War and her experiences in Oklahoma. And she related some of the skirmishes involving the Indians and either one army or the other. Mostly the Indians participated on the side of the South. But nevertheless, she said this, a shocking thing to me. She said, "Well, did you realize," she said, "that my mother lived during the time of Washington?" Well, I didn't realize that this was even a possibility, but when she related it, and she was born sometime in the early quarter of the 18th century, somewhere, it seemed to me like around 1830 or thereabouts, because she related this about her mother and about living, and they were on the East Coast at that time, along in Georgia, I believe it was, she said. Now, my grandmother's name was Crotchet, and she did have Indian blood, and it was Cherokee. I never was particularly interested in that phase of my ancestry because, not that I was ashamed to ask, but it appeared to me that a great many people who, of questionable character, morals, and reputation oftentimes claimed to be part Indian when in reality they would be a disgrace if it were true. So in all of my years of experience, I never have particularly did any research to find out just how many in our family were of Indian blood or to some extent. I think that's kind of beside the point. I like to think of Indians just being good Americans. In fact, Americans, they were the first Americans, 100% Americans. So that never did bother me. But she was a great woman, and she did look her Indian heritage because she had this appearance. And the pictures that I use in the book that was edited and published about my life in the schools of Oklahoma reflects her picture and also a little story about her early life in Georgia and in Tennessee and then in Oklahoma. But I do know that I had in Oklahoma a great many relatives, many of whom I have never met, because of the 11 brothers my father had, and most of them lived in Oklahoma or had come to Oklahoma and then dispersed. But many of them did remain here until their death, and they also raised large families. So I really have never met all of my relatives that live in Oklahoma.
Did your grandmother have Indian lands in the Cherokee Nation?
Yes, she did. And after my grandfather, Knight, who was a full-blooded Englishman, after he died, and he died an untimely death, and I don't talk much about that because he was killed accidentally. Well, I don't know if it was accidentally or not, but he was drugged home, and the assumption was he was shot, and a horse drug him home, and the assumption was that the horse killed him by he had his foot caught in the stirrup, and he had been mangled. And the wound that he had was not sufficient to have killed him. But this was during they were having tribal elections, and he participated to some extent, and these were hot affairs. in the eastern part of Indian Territory. So this is how he met.
When
he,
was this?
Oh, I can't set any date on that. I'm sorry that I didn't ask that, but I never met him myself. So you can tell it's been some time. So he was dead. But this was an early part of Indian Territory history is when he met his death. But she married another man, and he disposed of her property against her will or without her consent. And there was some effort to repossess the land, and it was around Blue Jacket. So she did have an Indian allotment. It wasn't a lot of land. By that I mean when they made an allocation under the Dawes Commission, why these parcels of land that were, it was in terms of your Indian blood as to how much you received. And as I recall, she didn't receive a great deal of land, something like 30 or 40 acres. But it was disposed of, and they tried to repossess it because it became mineral land. Where she was living, there was coal and later some ore.
Do you recall any other experiences that she may have mentioned, either in Oklahoma or in the move to Oklahoma?
Well, she used to tell me about the hazardous times they had in living in Oklahoma, not only to gain a livelihood, but there were even wild animals that attacked people in this early day. Panthers, for example, and other types of wildlife that oftentimes it was dangerous for children. She related that to me and told some stories about children that were lost their lives due to wild animals. So they lived in a primarily a sod house when they first set up housekeeping there, and then they later developed the homestead that they had there. And my father later participated in the Oklahoma Run when they opened up Oklahoma. However, she or nor her husband did. Now, she, as I say, she remarried again, so he did not participate. But it's been some time since I had this privilege. As you recall, it's been over 50 years since I saw her. So I don't recall vividly all of the conversations that I did have with her, but I did have a high regard for anything that she said. She's a very quiet woman and was not filled with descriptive words as she related her early experiences. But sufficiently that she talked meaningfully to me and impressed me very much while I was a student in high school. And I always admired her very much because of the principles that guided her life and the respect for integrity and truthfulness and all of these things that I think are valuable in judging human character.
Did she recollect either directly or indirectly the Trail of Tears? Was her period of travel?
No, I never asked that question. That was a little before the time. As I recall, that was about 1834. And they were living over in Kingston, Tennessee, but I didn't recall when they came to Kingston. And whether or not she participated, I do not think she participated in the Trail of Tears, but came to Oklahoma after the Trail of Tears.
You say your father made the run?
Yes, he did.
Where did he run to?
Well, it was out on the western border. It seemed to me like about somewhere near Arkansas City, Kansas, where they crossed over. And he related to me, he was in a wagon, a covered wagon, and a team, and he had with him another, he had a brother, And the brother lived over at down over no, I can't
Murray.
Recall
Perry.
Perry. And he homesteaded there, and my father, for some reason or other, I think he staked a claim, but he didn't follow through on it. He described this to me several times about his experiences. It was a kind of a lark for people to participate anyway. So they went over there just to, as boys, to see what it was like. And there were, as you know, many Sooners that staked out a homestead prior to the opening. This was really against territorial law, but nevertheless, some of this did take place. And that's, I guess, accounts for the Sooners.
Did your father, your father actually came across and claimed land, even though he didn't?
Yes, he did. He did.
What happens to that land? Does it, they had to live on it for a period of time.
Yes, that's right.
What happened to his?
Well, I don't think he established a firm legal, he didn't stay long enough to establish a firm legal claim. You had to register, you know, there's a lot of things that were necessary, and you had to live on it a certain length of time to validate your claim. Then there was a lot of claim jumping, and there was trouble where there might be several claims to the same land. But the first one to register this, I believe they had to go to Guthrie to do this, but anyway, he never did establish firm claim. Now, my uncle did, Uncle Henry, who lived at Perry, and he did establish a firm claim to a homestead.
Did your father describe what happened at the run particularly? Do you recall any descriptions of things that happened?
Well, only the kind of people that gathered there. There were all types and descriptions of people. Some men of no principle at all, and they were selling even water. That was a scarce item. You could almost buy whiskey cheaper than you could buy water. But anyway, it was quite an affair, and they had every means of travel in making that run, from walking to horseback and covered wagons and teams and rigs of all types. And it was a mad scramble because everybody was anxious to stake a claim. And as I say, there was some trouble among the people who were making the run. They were not always the kind of people that I think Oklahoma would welcome. And that's the reason our early history in Oklahoma was filled with a lot of people without principles that would reflect good citizenship. And there were a lot of murders and various other things that went on that were not anything that you would want to record in history anyway. But there was a lot of conflict of various kinds that took place during this period of development.
What year did you say? Did you say it was 1920 when you first came to Tulsa, first saw Tulsa?
Yes, I came down during the race riot just to see what was going on.
Did you see the race riot?
Yes, I saw evidence of it.
Why don't you describe everything you know about that?
Well, this was primarily, I can't recall just what started it, but I do know that a number of people, the Negroes, were over on the north side of the railroad tracks. And when nightfall came, and I think it started at the Tulsa Hotel, the first incident that created the riot that resulted in the race confrontation between the whites and the blacks. And I would say that the percentage of loss of life was more prevalent with the Negro race at this particular time, and it was well publicized in the press about the riot in Tulsa. So I came down. I was just out of high school when I came down. And I had just made a journey in an old Model T Ford, about 1916 or earlier vintage. And we drove down, and we didn't hit any pavement. Coming from Pittsburgh, Kansas, we didn't hit any pavement till we got into the Tulsa City limits to a street on Peoria, where the railroad tracks crossed the Peoria Avenue. And so I came on, and with another fellow that was with me, and we did see evidence of the riot. We're cautioned by police to not to involve ourselves in this, and we were shied away from the area where incidents could have occurred, but it was something not to to experience, but a lot of curiosity seekers were present along with myself coming to Tulsa, and that's the first view I had of Tulsa, and I will say at that time it wasn't very impressive. Some pavement, as I say, I reached pavement on Peoria at about First Street, and the rest of it was dirt road, clear up through Skiatook and on to the Kansas line. It was just a country dirt road, and if it rained a little bit, you had the hazard of getting stuck and having to have somebody to pull you out and all that sort of thing. Fortunately, on this trip, that didn't happen to us. But just a couple of young fellows that were out for a lark on a weekend to see what was happening in Tulsa. And as I say, there were a lot of gun toters and a lot of men who were shooting other people almost on sight with no provocation, other than maybe they were identified as a particular race, and they fired at will. And I couldn't say how much life was lost in Tulsa at that time, but it was considerable, because I was not a resident of Tulsa. I was just a curiosity seeker, a young fellow who came down from Kansas right after I got out of high school.
Now, you came to Hominy in what year, 1925?
In 1925.
What brought you to Hominy?
Well, an opportunity to try my wings at the teaching business. I had, while I was in Pittsburgh, engaged in many different activities. And after I graduated, I had heard about the opportunities for teaching in Oklahoma. So I came down to Pawhuska as the first stop I made, and talked to the superintendent there, and he was very much interested in my preparation and my candidacy, and he said he'd let me know. So I didn't get a definite answer, so I went on down to Hominy and met a man by the name of A.W. Beavers, who was then the superintendent of schools, and I wasn't with him 30 minutes until he had a contract ready for me to sign. So I stayed in Hominy for 4 years and got acquainted with a great many Indians as well as the whites in that community. And I really had 4 profitable years there. Then I had an opportunity to come to Tulsa, which I took, and came here in the school year of 29 and 30.
Would you describe the town of Hominy at the time you came?
Well, Hominy, when I came down in 25, did have some paved streets. It had, I think, one east and west one and one north and south, which was the north and south street. I can't recall its name even, but there was an east and west paved street, which was the main street of downtown Hominy. Now, there were a great many Osage Indians living in Hominy. And they were on a oil royalty headright basis. They were receiving for each headright something like about $4,000 a quarter, which was an awful lot of money. They had struck oil in the Osage, and these were restricted Indians. Each of them had a guardian, and I got well acquainted with the Indian people in Hominy, and I made some lasting friendships with the Indians, and I had the privilege of addressing a powwow there at the insistence of Chief Bacon Ryan and John Abbott, who was the Tulsa counterpart of the Osage leadership in Hominy. So it was on John Abbott's place that I addressed there this powwow on February 22nd, about 1925 or 6, somewhere along. Maybe it might have been 27. But anyway,
describe the powwow before
The powwow was quite a large group had assembled there. I'd say 300 or 400 Indian men and some women in the audience, and they came down to the high school. One of the Indians, John Abbott, a full-blood Osage, and asked me if I wouldn't come out and address the group. And I said, well, John, why don't you try the president of the bank, Ray Mullendore, or some member of the Board of Education, or maybe the secretary of the Chamber of Commerce? And he said, already try him. We want you. Well, I said, John, when do you want me to speak? He said, tomorrow, George Washington's birthday. And I said, that's kind of short order, but if you want me, John, I'll do anything you ask me to do. And I'd be glad to meet this group of Indian friends that you've gathered from New Mexico and Western Oklahoma. There were I know, must have been representatives maybe from Wyoming and Colorado. It was a Western segment of the population that now meet in Gallup. So I know that this organization was there that day, and I looked out among about 300 or 400 stoic faces, and this was an unusual experience because I did attempt to do a good patriotic job. But the unusual thing about the experience was that I never knew when I was turning anybody on or off, either one. But I had an interpreter, and he stood by my side, and I had a microphone with me over which I was speaking, and I'd make a dissertation maybe of 5 minutes long, and my interpreter would say in one sentence what it took me 5 minutes to say. And then I would start out, and maybe I would just make one sentence, and he'd stop me again by laying his hand over my shoulder, on my arm. And then he'd talk for 5 minutes on what I said in one sentence. This was a most unusual experience, and I shall always remember it. But they were very kind and appreciated my accepting their invitation. And the next day, following this powwow, the end of it, the Indians, John Abbott, brought me two new Indian blankets, which I still have as a memento of that occasion. But it was quite an experience, and I shall long remember it. And I have a host of Indian friends, as well as others who are not Indian, in Hominy. And this has been a long time ago, but I frequently get a visit from an Osage Indian, and Paul Pitts was a real close friend of mine, and he's deceased now, but he was the last Osage chief that I was personally acquainted with, but he died about a year ago.
Who were some of the leaders in Hominy in that early period?
Well, I spoke of John Abbott. Then there was Shunkamola. I'm talking about Indians. And then there were quite a number of prominent businessmen who served as guardians. The Drummonds, who lived there, and Carl Matthews, and Harry Matlis, Ray Mullendore, and Mr. Cromer, and J.A. Presbury, and people of this, citizens of this stature, and they were all prominent businessmen who served as guardians for the Indians, and they were restricted, and they handled their money.
The Mullendore family has come up a number of times in interviewing people. Obviously, they're a very prominent family, and of course, we're in the news last fall.
Well, this Ray in Hominy was the president of the bank, and also was related to all of the Mullendores in Cleveland as well as up on the ranch.
Could you give us some background that you knew them of the Mullendores?
Well, the Mullendores were a very conservative family, and they made wise investments in land and real estate of various forms, but they were highly regarded by the citizenry of Hominy. They were outstanding leaders, I would say, and big property owners, especially those from Cleveland, who is also in the banking business and the cattle business, and also several other families there, that the Pettits and the Crows were also very prominent in the Indian activities in and around Hominy. And Fred Petty was the only white man outside of myself at the powwow. And I have a complete picture of these Osages. It hangs in my study at home. So I prized their picture. He delivered a picture along with the two blankets.
Are they in the book?
I don't recall whether those were recorded in the book or not, but I'll bring you a copy of the book. And the title of the book is Toward Excellence. This is a kind of a word that kind of defined me. I was constantly seeking ways to improve the high school, to make Will Rogers High School one of America's best. And I think we fairly well succeeded. We're known in every major educational institution in America, and from Washington to California. And our graduates are scattered all over the United States and around the globe. So I had a very exciting and profitable 20 years at Will Rogers High School, which I shall cherish for the rest of the days of my life.
Well, we met one of your graduates on campus today,
Yes.
I understand you have several others.
Yes, she said there were five others. Well, everywhere I go is a similar experience, but I'm glad to know we're represented at Oklahoma Christian College, because I think this is a fine institution. And I think what you have to offer here is greatly needed to give guidance and direction to some wayward youth that probably have lost their orientation. I have been impressed about that in this institution. It looked to me like you are the kind of people that I left at Will Rogers High School, well-regulated and respectful. There are some other educational institutions that are a little frightening to see some of the people. I don't know whether they're really affiliated with the institution or whether they're just on campus. I also experienced this back at Princeton several times. I go once a year on a national scholarship board. This year will be my last year on the board, but we award $175,000 to $250,000 a year, and we do this to college that is primarily high school students entering college. We grant these, some of them, four-year scholarships, but most of them are an annual scholarship. So this is a very interesting part of my professional experience, so I cherish it also.
I wonder if you would describe the school at Hominy when you were first there.
Well, when I was at Hominy, the high school was relatively new, but it was a three-story structure that would accommodate, I would say, around 600 students, about what we had. But I was there during the beginning of the Depression. It had already begun to bother us in Oklahoma. That is, the crash that came in 1929, but there was a recession before that. But it just hit the stock market in 1929. And we closed, after it did hit, we closed our home economics department and our shops. And most of our young people, I was never quite satisfied, and my recommendation was not to close that. We kept French and Spanish and Latin in our curriculum and cut out homemaking physical education, and also the shops were closed as an economy measure, primarily because those were not necessary to enter college, and the school board thought that if they just had a limited amount of money, that they would rather let close the shops because they were expensive to operate, and the home economics laboratory, and keep the academic subjects such as the foreign languages, and of course English and other mathematics, history, etc. We had just an academic program during the years that I was there, with the exception of the first year. Incidentally, I might tell you that one of my companions and one of my assistant principals later became president of J.C. Penney Company in New York and was one of their top executives. This is Jordan, is his name, Ray Jordan. And we had a great experience together because we were kind of a team. I had him in charge of the junior high school, and I had the senior high school, and it was a combined school. And we had two structures, or three structures, the shops, the junior high school on the same grounds, and then the three-story building for the high school. We had some illustrious visitors at the Hominy High School from time to time, including Alfalfa Bill Murray, I recall, visited us one time and spoke. He spoke to student body on, he had just returned from South America. I believe it was Bolivia. And, of course, he came to speak to the high school because he was seeking to run for election as governor of Oklahoma. And when I looked at that man and talked with him, I said, well, I doubt if this man will ever get enough votes to be elected governor. And while he was sitting in my small office there, he had a chew of tobacco in his mouth. And he looked around my office and says, where's your spittoon? I said, Mr. Murray, I'm sorry, but the school board doesn't furnish that. I said, just open that window there, and you can expectorate out the window, which he did, and it was a windy day. And it blew back against the Florentine glass, and before the rain washed that gob of tobacco juice off of my office window, he was in the governor's chair. And I frequently took people by the high school and showed them that spot up on that glass in my office. I said, there's where the governor spat.
Did you leave it there?
Yeah, I left it there. Yeah, all during the time is... I hoped that he'd return to Hominy High School again because while after he made a real fine speech on Bolivia, and he had a wonderful presentation, a wonderful voice, and as he left, he asked me if I wouldn't like to make a small contribution toward his campaign. And I said, what do you want, Mr. Murray? And he said, just enough to get me up to Pawhuska. He said, if you could give me the equivalent of bus fare to Pawhuska, I'd really appreciate it. I said, well, Mr. Murray, you have it, and my good wishes. And I still didn't think that this man had a chance to be elected, but I was in error. And I visited him in the Capitol after he was elected. And he was a great character and had a great deal of wisdom and a fine delivery as a speechmaker. I remember him fondly.
You were one of his big contributors.
Yes, $2.
did you get any offices out of it?
No, not a thing. I wasn't looking for any.
He does do.
Where were we?
We just talked about Bill Murray, and I think we're still on the Hominy schools.
Well, I would say this about my experiences in Hominy. I count a great many friends among the citizens of Hominy. A great many of them are now deceased. However, I have a great many Indian friends there. Many of them, Walter Maton, the Shunkamolas, and the Burkharts, and a great many other people that I don't recall right off, that is the Indians, how the, of course, the white people in Hominy who were leaders in the city were people like Fred Drummond and Gent Drummond and Cecil Drummond, Carl Matthews, Mr. Overby, J.A. Presbury, Mr. Cromer, or Comer, I guess it is, and Ray Mollendor, and Harry Matless, Sam Gordon, who used to live there, moved to later to Norman in a dry goods business. But as I would say, I was treated very well in Hominy by the people and by the students. And we had a good high school program. It was primarily academic by reason of the shortness of budget, and we eliminated those things that were not absolutely essential for college entrance. But being a more or less of an agricultural and oil community, I thought we probably should have preserved the shops and the home economics department rather than closing them, because those were closer to the people, because we only sent about 30% of our student body to college. So 70% could have profited by home economics and shop work. But nevertheless, that's water under the bridge. That was a decision of the Board of Education, and I had little to do other than just to make a recommendation, which they didn't see fit to take, because they couldn't afford it, so they said. We still have the problems of adequately financing education even to this very moment, and I have my hopes up that sooner or later the legislature, the governor, and the people of Oklahoma are gonna be enthusiastically supporting increasing revenues for the support of public education.
Now you went from Hominy. Can you think of any news events or any particular events in Hominy outside of what we've talked about that might be worth mentioning when you were there?
Well, I can't recall any particular incident. People in Hominy, generally speaking, were very much interested in their schools. And I think the school system for a small town was about as good as you could expect from a school oriented like it was in Indian culture as well as in white people.
You went to Tulsa, and you mentioned having known Will Rogers. When was this? Was this before you went to Tulsa?
Yes, this was while I was still in Pittsburgh, Kansas. One time I I visited in the home of the potentate of the Mystic Shrine in Pittsburgh, Kansas, who I happened to know him personally because he had a son my age. So one day I saw him on the street, and he told me about the shrine in Pittsburgh was going to have a special guest on their Saturday night banquet, and Will Rogers was going to speak. And Mr. Pingree was his name. Mr. Pingree asked me, he said, would you like to meet Will Rogers? Oh, I said, I surely would. And he said, well, why don't you come out to my house? You're going to be out to my house in the middle of the afternoon. Why don't you just drop by there, and I'll see that you meet him. The reason Mr. Pingree was a close friend of mine is my wife-to-be was one of his secretaries. So I had a relationship there which gave rise to him inviting me out to his house. Well, I went out there and I met Mr. Rogers, and I was still in college, and he asked me the question. He said, what do you intend to be? And I said, well, as it looks at the present time, I'm going to be a school teacher. And he kind of ducked his head, and he said, well, you know, he said, I had a niece that was just dying to be a teacher. And then he put his finger up over his nose and looked up over his glasses and looked up at me, and he said, she darn near did. And then he further responded, said, starved to death. Well, this is typical of Rogers' humor. He was as funny. He saw funny things in everyday living, every waking moment of that man. He was a humorist. He just saw relationships among people that were just comical, and that's a good example. He had them laughing all afternoon. And now he was not a, this happened to be a elbow-bending affair in which they were serving highballs, and but Mr. Rogers didn't participate. Also, he didn't smoke, and at least I never did see him smoke. I never did see him take any alcoholic beverage. He was pretty, he had pretty high standards for himself and his family. But I'm not saying that in his earlier days he probably deviated from that, according to what I learned by some of his writings in correspondence that I've read to his father, that he did imbibe occasionally in his younger days when he was a cowboy down in Texas and down in South America and in Africa, in South Africa. He had quite an experience as a cowboy, and he joined several Wild West shows, and this is how he got his start in show business, is through Zach Muller, Mulhall, and several other rodeo circuits that he was on. And he really was a champion roper, a highly skilled fella, and then he just accidentally got to having a monologue while he was twisting his rope on stage, and he just accidentally fell into this matter of writing, making daily telegrams and weekly reports to the press, which they paid him a handsome sum, some $1,000 a week just for his comments. And of course he was skilled at repartee in various ways. You wouldn't ever want to choose him to oppose in any discussion on current items, because he had more knowledge than anybody I ever met. Then I met him in Tulsa, in a Tulsa World office with Norris Henthorn. This is a short time before he made his Alaskan trip, and I was on a board with Mr. Can't think of his name. Norris Henthorn, who was editor of the Tulsa World and also on the Will Rogers Memorial Commission, but also on a park board with me. So Mr. Henthorn called me and asked me if I'd like to come by and meet Will Rogers, who's up in his office. And he just did this as a friend because I knew his family and I was in the schools at that time. And so I went by the world and met Mr. Rogers again. So I have a strong feeling for my relationship to the memorial. And I've been on the board now for 8 years.
And you're chairman of the board now.
I'm chairman of the board now. And we're in the process of publishing the works of Will Rogers. And this is being done at Oklahoma State University. And I think people are going to be amazed at how much writing he did. It looks like it's going to be about 14 or 15 volumes, and there will be perhaps 400 or 500 pages in each volume. These are not going to be sold publicly, but they will be made available to colleges, universities, and corporations that have their own private libraries that would like to make an order. But we're only publishing 3,000 copies for the United States and the rest of the world. So we are not going on the newsstands. We may publish one volume, which will be the 6 books that Will Rogers wrote and edited himself, and we may publish those in one volume and distribute that widely to those who desire it. But most people will not want to buy the whole set. They'll sell for about $15 a copy, and that is prohibitive for most private libraries. But I think we're going to have no difficulty in selling the life of Will Rogers and his writings as he lived it and commented to every notable in the United States for a period of about 25 years, I'd say, something like that.
We sent some biography to Will Rogers material up there for the purpose of OSU. Now, this brings us to your moving to Tulsa.
Yes.
And you came there about 1930, is that correct?
That's correct.
I'm thinking in terms of the fact that you must have come there not too long after that gubernatorial election because
Governor
Bill Murray was elected in 1930.
Yes, sir. That's when he had the fire bell measures.
Yes, the
fire bell measures, you know?
Yes.
That's what he called them.
Why don't you talk about that?
I talked to Mr. Murray one time, and I said, Mr. Murray, you're in a peculiar, precarious position being governor of the state of Oklahoma. I said, aren't you afraid that you'll be one of the guys that they'll try to impeach? And he said in a big, deep voice, he said, if they ever do, he said, it'll be like a bunch of rabbits trailing a tree and a wildcat. And he meant it.
I think when you finish the Will Rogers book, that we ought to start a Bill Murray.
Yeah, I think
got
so.
Nothing to on tape to give it.
I wouldn't doubt it. He was a great character, Bill Murray was, and a smart man.
No question. Can you think of any other stories regarding him?
No. Now I got to know Johnston Murray perhaps better than I knew Bill, but I was in Bill's office during his term, and he remembered fondly my relationship with him at Hominy High School. So there were a lot of people in Hominy that voted for Mr. Murray, and they gave him strong support in Hominy.
Tell us about coming to Tulsa.
Well, I came to Tulsa as a result of a convention I attended in Dallas, and I met the personnel director of the Tulsa Public Schools in Dallas at this convention. This was Kiwanis Convention. And he was visiting with me, and he said, do you have an application on file in Tulsa? I said, no, sir, I don't, Mr. Gons. He said, well, about everybody else does. He said, I don't know why you shouldn't. Well, I said, is this you recommending that I file an application with you? I said, you're the personnel director, aren't you? And he said, I am. And I would. He said, I'd welcome an application from you. And he said, I can't promise you anything immediate, but he said, I want to say this to you, that I won't forget you. So I filed the application, and it stayed on his desk, I don't know how long. And I occasionally, when I was in Tulsa, would go by and see him. And the last time he said, I'm going to surprise you. He said, I don't think you think we're going to hire you, but we are. And he said, I'll have something this fall for you. This is what he said to me when I visited Mr. Gowans. And he was a great character too. He served under Merle Prunty as the director of personnel. Then later himself became superintendent of schools, and also business manager. He had a very fine term as superintendent, 9 years, and He was a very human sort of superintendent. He wasn't as well versed in educational practices as perhaps he should have been, but nevertheless, he understood human nature better than any man I believe I ever met. He had an insight into character and understanding of people and their acts of behavior. And he read them just about right every time. So my tenure in Tulsa is remembered for some of the years I spent with Dr. Harry Gons.
Why don't you describe the Tulsa? You started off in the grade school.
Yes, I did.
Why don't you describe the Tulsa schools and the Tulsa and education as you viewed it at that time, as it was at that time?
Well, in 1930, it was harrowing times to meet the budget. So we had a lot of budgetary problems in Tulsa, but we had a good staff. We were in the process of retrenchment, and we laid off a lot of teachers because we had to retrench in order to conserve the budget. The budget then for the whole school system wouldn't carry the Tulsa schools for 1 month. And that was for a year they had the budget. In those days, our physical property had all run down. The maintenance department operated on a shoestring. They couldn't even fix a leak in the roof because we didn't have the money. But as far as schools are concerned, I think we've always had a fine record in Tulsa for good educational leadership, and the present time is no exception. So I feel that Tulsa wanted the best for their children, and they always voted the maximum. And this is reflected in the quality of education that you find in most of Tulsa's schools, even today, with all of the need for improving the situation with more funds. They still have a very fine, well-regulated school system. And I keep up with that at the present moment as well. I make myself available to anybody who still wants to contact me. But I, as an executive of the Blue Cross Blue Shield program, I do have reason to keep in touch with the public schools. I'm saying more about schools.
Can you name some of your pupils over the years, starting thinking just kind of generally chronologically, of some of your students who have made a particular note in what might be any phase of Oklahoma history? I mean, for instance, you mentioned Anita Bryant, who was Miss Oklahoma,
yes,
and was a runner-up for Miss America, and who is now one of the leading entertainers in the country. I'm sure there are others. Would you like to discuss
yes.
with them?
I want to say for Anita, she's one of the finest
mention
young...
her name because again.
Miss Anita Bryant Green. Her last name is Green now. She married Bob Green from Miami, who is a disc jockey down there. But he's a very fine young man, and they're happily married and have four children now. Three of their own and one they adopted before the three came along. But Anita was a wonderful person. She has a religious background and loves to attend religious conferences and has accepted invitations on many occasions. She's made 14 appearances at the White House alone. And I think it would be fair to say that Anita was an ideal student in high school and participated in all of the student activities as well as being a good, bright girl in the classroom and carried an excellent record. She was also in our music department and was a soloist and sang many times in the assembly, and it was in the assembly singing in the a cappella choir that she got the inspiration for singing the Battle Hymn of the Republic. And we did this in an expert manner at Will Rogers High School. It just run chills down your back to listen to our a cappella choir sing the Battle Hymn of the Republic. I never heard it any better anywhere. This gave Anita an inspiration. She was a soloist in this, and this is what she usually sings on national hookups because nobody can do it any better than she does. And she knows all the words, too. She doesn't grope around. But she usually, when she entertains at the White House, and this has been for every president since she graduated, and she sings this song with particular feeling and meaning. She really believes in the United States of America. And a great many people today of her age may have some misgivings about their loyalty because of the war and other related things thereto, such as crime and bombing and this and that, which characterizes the resistance movement among the youth of America and among the dissidents, such as these people who've been segregated by color. But anyway, we had many illustrious graduates of Will Rogers High School, none of least, of course, is Buddy Fallis, the district attorney in Tulsa, who is carrying on a very effective campaign against the use of drugs and an educational program along this line. We did strive at Will Rogers High School to be an exceptional school in that we had high purpose and we had goals set by the students and the teachers. We had lots of pupil-teacher planning and lots of innovations, and we have been rated by various organizations nationwide as being in the top 10 high schools of America. And we didn't get that by just wishful thinking and just false loyalty. We wanted to be good, and we think we proved that we were from all the standards that are used to judge a school. And I did appreciate the loyalty of the students, but we had more than loyalty. We had accountability for our time and our effort, and our students became lawyers, doctors, dentists, musicians, school teachers galore, have been graduates of Will Rogers High School during my tenure in that high school, and since, of course, also. So we're very proud of the name we bear, and we try to implement the philosophy of Will Rogers in the student body. And this is reflected particularly in our assemblies, which we held once a week without any deviation from that habit of having a weekly meeting of minds. And all of the programs on the assembly program are presented by the student body, not by the teachers nor the principal. The only time I ever appeared on stage was when I was invited by the chairman of the assembly, and I responded every time that they wanted me to, but usually I sat in the audience. But as I say, Anita is a good example of perhaps our most outstanding graduate. We have men of ability in practically every line of endeavor in American life. We have scientists, we have every phase of the medical profession, and I've been across the United States I can't say how many times, and I never fail to meet a student from Will Rogers wherever I go, whether it's New York, Princeton, Washington, Miami, Florida, or wherever it is, on the West Coast likewise. So we're very proud of the record and the name we bear at Will Rogers High School.
When was Will Rogers High School formed?
It opened in the fall of 39 and graduated its first class in 40.
When did you become principal?
I became in 1950 and finished at the end of 69.
Can you think of any outstanding events of particular interest in Will Rogers High School that might be worth mentioning?
Well, one thing we prided ourselves in, Francis Bellamy wrote the Pledge of Allegiance to the Flag, Boston Patriot, and we used this in our assembly. Every time we assembled, we had a protocol to follow, and it included the Pledge to the Flag, which our people did nobly and with respect. And then the American's Creed was also a part of our ritual, which I think is more impressive than the Pledge of Allegiance to the Flag. I have to regret to say that many of our visitors, while we were repeating the American Creed, they didn't know it. But it was written by William Tyler Page a long time ago at Annapolis, Maryland, and it's encased in bronze, the original of the American Creed in that institution right across from the Naval Academy, in the Annapolis Courthouse, or rather, State House. But I've always prided ourselves in having a very progressive school curriculum, one that would give our young people every advantage of preparing themselves for further education or adjusting themselves to what life's work they wanted to choose. So I was very proud to be principal of the school and to be privileged to associate with all the thousands of students that I called members of the graduating class of Will Rogers High School. And I still keep in close touch with many of them, or they keep in touch with me.
What was to you the most exciting incident that happened during the period you were principal of Will Rogers?
Oh, I think in addition to the assemblies, and we received a Bellamy Award, which was given to us by a national organization listing Will Rogers High School as particularly good in developing a citizenship program. And they picked us to receive this award in 1957. And they only pick one school every 50 years. And we got it in 1957, so we won't hear from that organization again until 2007. So, but we tried to carry out the spirit that we think made America, and that is respect for our nation, for our flag, for our institutions. And our young people, I think, benefited more when they had this kind of an attitude and feeling about their own school. They did a better job in the classroom. And our teachers likewise responded, and they were treated with respect, generally speaking. I don't know of anyone that was ever mistreated, but maybe that's not true today, but I hope it is. But times do change people and things. But I think one of the things that we did at Will Rogers that pleased me a great deal was that Dr. Zacharias from MIT met me in Tulsa one time at the Mayo Hotel and asked me if I'd like to participate in a physical science study committee program sponsored by the President of the United States, who was Eisenhower at the time. And this is the time Sputnik went up and all the high schools were failing in science and mathematics, and this was a new program in physics, and he wanted to know that we'd be one of 50 schools that would be pilot schools for the study of the physical science study committee appointed by the President of the United States. And we served in that capacity and became a pilot school in the physics department for that program. I would say that was the outstanding thing that we did, in addition to being rated highly by North Central and by every college and university where we sent our students. So this, I would say, it was a privilege to be affiliated with true professional teachers and also to be a part of a good school system that provided the means whereby it's possible to do this.
The you were an officer and later president of the OEA.
Yes.
Why don't you talk about some of the problems that schools have had? I know that over the years, I know that there once was a period during the 30s when many schools couldn't make their payroll, had to give IOUs, and why don't you discuss chronologically some of the problems of education?
Well, I would want to place a citizenship program first. However, I think you'd have to say that the first objective of education is health. And then after that, there are a number of objectives that we've prescribed in setting forth our philosophy. And our philosophy was a guide to what took place in the classroom. We tried to give every offering that money would afford from the Board of Education in Tulsa at Will Rogers High School. And we thought we had a pretty broad curriculum. And while schools would be limited, small rural schools might be limited to 30 units, we had about 130 units of offering to our students. So it was a highly selective curriculum. And there were some required subjects, which were the what you might call the core of the program. It's called general education. And this provided everybody with some required courses in English, science, and math. And these were not large in number. It was 7 units. And the balance of it was elective. So a student could elect a field of specialty, although we didn't say we were specializing in high school. But we did want to prepare every student to further his education if he so desired. And we didn't think that the high school should be the terminal point for education. Fact of the matter is, I don't know if there is any terminal point today. As we said at Will Rogers at one time, if you dropped your pencil at Will Rogers, stooped down to pick it up, you'd be behind. Things were changing about that fast. So we participated in all the progressive programs that we thought fitted our needs and interests and abilities. And I think I view education, my definition of education is merely a modification of behavior. And we never forgot that in everything we did. We wanted to improve our behavior every day. In a positive way, not in a negative way. But today, we see a lot of things where we might have some question as to whether it was positive. The mode of dress, as well as a mode of behavior, this was not a problem to us, but it has become one since I left, even. It has become more of a problem in every high school. And we never had any drug problem. We did have occasional disagreement among students that might have some unpleasant... demonstrations of undesirable behavior, but generally speaking... I would say most students in the high school have an excellent attitude and an excellent record. I think that's as it should be. We think every student is important and worthy of a teacher's time. And nobody has been put in a categorized group because of his limitations of experience or maybe... his knowledge or his aptitude for knowledge. But nevertheless, we try to provide a program that each could live up to his potential and use his aptitudes to improve himself and to move toward excellence to the extent of his ability.
Why don't you talk about your career as president-elect and as president of the Oklahoma Education Association and the period of the sanctions and what was involved there.
I was the first president-elect of OEA in 63-64 and became president in 64-65. And during my tenure, and by the way, I really didn't want to accept that job, but because I knew it would take me away from Will Rogers High School a great deal. But I was imposed on to respond to a call because we were at low ebb as far as financing schools in Oklahoma. And the legislature didn't seem to be inclined to want to make any big strides of improvement. And then we had a change of politics in the State House, so... not only the legislature was having difficulty in finding the money, but also the governor was limited in what he thought could be possible to finance in Oklahoma. But we were so dissatisfied with the low salaries and our people leaving Oklahoma, our better teachers going to California or whatever you, where they could get a decent living wage, which we were not paying. So we had a rough time for a while in Tulsa, During this particular period, we lost a great many of our good teachers to California and many other places, and we got replacements from people who were not as well qualified personally or professionally. So we never have caught up, in my opinion, where we ought to be. So I think the new governor is assessing the situation just about right. If we ought to be average in the United States, and we're 45th. Well, this is not an enviable position. And the only way to get better teachers and to improve your educational program is to provide more money, not just to pay teachers' salaries. You can always attract better teachers when you've got a better salary schedule, better prepared teachers, and better in performance, better in their role of leadership in leading children in the right direction. So when I became president of OEA, we had to meet with the legislature and the governor, and I don't know how many times that I had that experience, and I frequently appeared before the legislature as well as before the governor, trying to defend the legislative program that we hoped to implement during that session. We did make some progress, and Governor Bellman reluctantly, I would say, went as far as we wanted him to go. He did make some improvement, but we weren't keeping up with our bordering states, and we haven't to date. We keep getting farther and farther behind as we compare ourselves with the surrounding states. So I think that this present legislature and the governor-elect, and this is not discounting Mr. Bartlett's effort, a great deal of improvement was made during his term. But at this particular time that I'm speaking about, when I was president of OEA, I was the spokesman for the teachers. And I went about the state in every county of the state, meeting school people and patrons, trying to get them to put pressure on the legislature to find more money for education. But this has always been a hard thing to do because we adopted a philosophy during Roy Turner's administration that we've never laid it aside until this year, that no new taxes for any purpose. And this was had a bad effect upon the school system, because certainly you could justify spending money on education if it's going to improve youth and their opportunity for their future. So this is what I spent most of my time during that year, and it was a long year for me, trying to convince people that they should see their way toward exercising their influence on the legislature and the governor to raise more money to have better schools and give their own children a better opportunity. Well, we made some progress, but not as much as I would like to have seen. And of course, there has been considerable improvement since 64-65. We did invoke sanctions. We didn't go all the way. We didn't blackball Oklahoma, as we were accused of doing. We did not, but it was pretty well known across America that Oklahoma teachers were not going to stand still about this matter of increasing revenues for education. So we did make some progress as a result of imposing sanctions, and we kept everybody out of Oklahoma until conditions did improve. And any teacher who came into this state looking for a job was under sanctions and would be blackballed, couldn't even join the association if they had attempted to. So this had a pretty drastic effect upon the legislature as well as the governor, and we began to look for money. So we did make some progress, and I think laid the foundation for what's happened since in 64-65.
You are have been active with the Tulsa County Historical Society for some years, I know. Why don't you tell us what you can about the background of that organization?
Well, this has been in the Tulsa County Historical Society has been in existence for quite some time, but it's sort of been inactive in the last several years. It's an organization regulated by purposes and bylaws as trying to perpetuate a record of... I've been real pleased with the response of our former members in renewing their memberships, and we've employed an executive secretary, and he's a very knowledgeable fella, and he's really been working at this thing, and we are on our way toward rejuvenating an organization that has a program but lacks money, and we're going to see that that is provided. So that's going to be one of my major jobs, is to see that it's adequately financed and that we can do some of the things that are described in our objectives or in our bylaws and organization for existence, namely the laws and regulations that control the movement of the Tulsa County Historical Society. We have much to do, and we have interested members, and I predict that in a very short time we're going to announce a program that I think will gain a greater support than ever.
You are also a chairman, I believe, of the Will Rogers Memorial Commission. Have been on it a number of years. Why don't you tell about some of the things that that commission has been doing and during the past 8 years, and possibly what you are planning?
Well, annually we recognize Will Rogers' birthday on the 4th of November. And we bring to Oklahoma outstanding personalities who were friends of Will Rogers. And we have a very fine gathering of people interested in Will Rogers and the memorial. So during my tenure on the board, we've had a number of projects to improve the memorial. Since I've been on the board, we have air-conditioned it, which it didn't exist before. We have rebuilt a vault. We rebuilt the caretaker's home, and I refer to the manager as a caretaker. The manager and the curator, Mr. and Mrs. Bob Love, and they do an excellent job. It might be of some interest to you to know that this is the second biggest shrine in America so far as visitors, the number of visitors are concerned. Mount Vernon is number one, and the Will Rogers Memorial is number two. We exceed 900,000 every year, and sometimes it's exceeded 1 million people, visitors, a year. So it's open. The memorial is open 7 days a week, and from 9 until 5. And we have a full staff there, and Bob and Paula, their name is Love, and they really demonstrate their love for that institution. At the present time, our biggest project involves the university at OSU trying to set up ways and means of financing and publishing and editing the life story of Will Rogers, or rather, I should say, the works of Will Rogers, the papers that he had written. And we are going to publish some 14 or 15 volumes. And the first volume will come off sometime in the month of February, this month. And this will be made available to libraries throughout America.
This birthday, November what?
Fourth.
November 4th. Tell me, you mentioned you have a person who is a friend of his. Do you take that by any chance?
Yes, we do. So all of the visitors we've had Their speeches have been taped.
That's very fine. If sometime when I
yes.
get there, we'll want to make copies of that.
Yes. Our last speaker last November was Bob McCullough, who is the international president of Lions International from Tulsa, and he made a very fine presentation. And we've had all the movie stars, I would say, in recent years have come there. We've had Joel McRae was one of our special guests recently, and we had Bob Hope, and
those tapes are at the memorial.
Yes, they are. So this could be made available.
That's fine. I've had dinner in part of about a year or so ago with Paul and Love, and we are, in fact, we have supplied them with some tapes here, and we plan to go up there and take some of the material, including some of Will Rogers' old radio speeches that they have up there.
Well, I want to say this, that the legislature has been very considerate of us and have never rejected a well-rated budget. It's the only free shrine, I think, of this kind in America. And that's the reason we have all these visitors. It's open, and we don't sell a thing there except goodwill.
There's no question it's a good investment, whatever they put into it.
Well, the legislature and the governors elected for a number of years have given us their full support, as well as sufficient money to keep the building open on the schedule that we have. The cost for operation has gone up because we're on a 40-hour week with our employees and time and a half for overtime or double time. So this has hurt our operational procedure because we have... The budget runs about, it's close to $50,000, which isn't much of a budget. I think it's about $48,000, something like that, a year. That includes utilities and clerical help and janitorial help and that sort of thing. So
I don't see how they can do it today.
Well, it's pretty limited budget.
Mm-hmm.
So... We get our top help at a very reasonable fee, and the rest of it goes for employees. And now I have a copy of the budget. I haven't looked at it yet for this coming year. It could be up a little higher than that, but we used to get by on that amount, which isn't adequate.
No, it isn't accurate. That's very obvious. You've been over the years. You've had association with a number of the leaders in the Tulsa community. You've mentioned Norris Hinton and others. Why don't you talk a little about some of the individuals in Tulsa who are well known or who may be a part of history, with whom you've had personal contact, and maybe about whom you can tell us a personal reminiscence. It might give us a little additional viewpoint into a personality of an individual.
Well, I first would like to begin with Oklahoma Blue Cross Blue Shield, which I'm affiliated with Mr. Ralph Bethel, who is the president, and Mr. Bethel, I've known him all the years that he's been affiliated with Blue Cross Blue Shield, and also his predecessor, N.D. Helen, who first organized Oklahoma Blue Cross and Blue Shield beginning in the fall of 1939. And we got going by 1946. And I considered many things, but for part of my time, I'm the educational consultant for Blue Cross Blue Shield that carries on a continuous educational program of its employees, of which there are 455, I believe it is, employees in the Tulsa headquarters. We also have a divisional headquarters at Oklahoma City and Lawton, Chickasha, Muskogee, all those places I have visited, and I'm sure there's one or two. Enid, there are six branch offices. But anyway, the reason I joined Blue Cross Blue Shield is because the great need for health care within the teaching profession. And it's a non-profit organization, and it has excellent management with Mr. Bethel, who knows the history of the institution better than I do, but I know that we have written a fine record of performance to those who really needed health care. We're unfortunate in the rising costs of both hospital and medical care. Physicians' attentions are also going up in price, and this makes it a real heavy load on a family to carry the burden of Blue Cross membership for their entire family. But OEA, I think, is fortunate in having a master plan for all teachers and their families, and the rate is intensely low. It doesn't even meet the needs, and there's going to have to be some adjustment, I'm sure, as a new contract is renewed. But nevertheless, teachers and administrators are health conscious, and they utilize their health program, their prepaid health program, to the extent that no money is made on OEA group as a profession, as they participate in using their Blue Cross Blue Shield, because we usually have a deficit at the end of the year of, this year it'll be around $160,000. Now, for that reason, there will be some effort to make some kind of reconciliation and let teachers know. I have a brother in Chanute, Kansas, who has a family plan that cost him $51 a month, and in Oklahoma, right at the present time, it's $25.85, which is a real reasonable family rate. And we've had that for 2 years, and $10.85 for an individual, and also $3.95, I believe it is, for a student in college. So these are attractive rates that we've had through the Oklahoma Blue Cross and Blue Shield.
How long, tell us a little about its the thing that triggered the formation of the Oklahoma Blue Cross Blue Shield.
Well, when Mr. Helen came to Tulsa in the fall of 39, there had been a predecessor from Texas. See, Blue Cross Blue Shield started in Texas by a group of school teachers, and Mr. McBee came to Tulsa to start the program in Oklahoma. And he stayed only a relatively short time until Mr. Helen came down from Wisconsin and took over the leadership. And he'd been building for about 30 years. And, of course, he's deceased now. And Mr. Ralph Bethel was his first assistant and succeeded him and had his death. But health care is essential to every family and to every individual. And they must have some resources. It used to be it'd be almost impossible to get into a hospital. But with a Blue Cross card, you can get in the easiest of anything that I know of. But a person who isn't a member of Blue Cross almost has to sign his life away to get any consideration to getting into a hospital, if you need to. They want to know whether they're going to get paid or whether you have any resources. Now, it is true that many of them do get in that don't have any resources and don't have Blue Cross, and this makes the costs higher because a hospital has to absorb these losses of non-paying patients, and I guess they don't pay the doctor either. But nevertheless, this is a program that the people need, and this is the reason I'm affiliated, because I didn't want to sell anything except a service to people. And I'm dedicated to that goal, along with all of the people that are employees of the Blue Cross Blue Shield in Oklahoma.
How long have you been involved with it?
This is the second year, a little over a year.
After you?
Yes, that's right. It'll be 2 years this September.
How much association had you with them before?
Pretty close, because I have known Mr. Bethel as well as Mr. Helen and other employees of the organization, because being Principal Will Rogers High School, many of their students and many of their employees are graduates of Will Rogers High School. So I really value my affiliation with the Blue Cross highly, and they're a real reputable organization and real professional.
You handle education. What all is involved in that?
Well, Well, for example, people who process claims has to know a great deal about the human anatomy. If you're going to check all of the bills that are submitted for payment, either on the Blue Cross, which takes care of the hospitalization, or the Blue Shield, which takes care of the physicians and surgeons' bills that are sent in, to check them to see that they're not in error. So they're in a process of education all the time, studying the human anatomy, and also to understand the terminology that a doctor uses, so that they can process these claims in a proper manner and take care of the customer or the client or the member in the manner in which he is entitled to be taken care of. Now, we have some people who would use Blue Cross to maybe making false claims, which means that they're really cheating against their fellow member when they do this by accepting or presenting a false claim. And we usually check these out pretty carefully, but occasionally this does happen. We're not an insurance company at all. We're not after making any profit whatsoever. We just want to have the facilities that are necessary to render the service that the health care program must have in order to do business. And I think we have that in a 12-story building in Tulsa, a very fine property and worth much more than the Blue Cross members paid for it. And it's cheaper than renting a building. So it's not only built, but it's paid for also, so it doesn't cost anything except ad valorem taxes, which we pay. We don't have to pay, but we think it's only right to taxpayers that we should pay the ad valorem tax in wherever we reside, and we've done that. But I'm very proud of all the divisions and the professional work that they do. They have a communications department. They have a claims department. They have, an educational orientation department. They have a non-group department. They have CHAMPUS, which takes care of those in the armed services. They have Medicare. They process all of the claims for Medicare hospitalization, and that amounts to $50 million a year. And that's a service they do for the government without no profit, just what it costs to process Medicare claims for hospitalization. So it's a big organization. Our budget last year was $117 million.
That's for Oklahoma?
Yes. That's for the state of Oklahoma.
Now, what is your connection with the national?
The only connection we have is we belong to a national association of individual plans in each of our respective states, but each state has their own independent organization, and they do affiliate with a national organization which was created by the executives of the various state plans across the nation. So there is some, and we do this by paying dues to the national organization to keep the national office open. It's a coordinating office. And they render a lot of services. As you know, your Blue Cross card, no matter where you are in the United States or Europe or elsewhere around the world, will admit you to a hospital. And there is communications that has to go through the national office to coordinate your benefits and to see that you're taken care of wherever you are when you need the health care.
Can you think of any personalities, any other personalities with whom you have had a close enough association that you might know personal experiences, anecdotes, other things that might be of particular human interest? I'm not thinking so much in discussing in generalities as people that you may have an interesting story about.
Well, I think one of the things that impressed me very much is the caliber of citizens that serve on the two boards. There's two boards. There's a Blue Cross board, and then there's a Blue Shield board. The Blue Shield board is made up of doctors, and they help to write the contracts or rather furnish the information to write the contracts that each member has providing these services. So they have two boards, and these boards meet annually or more often if necessary. And these men give a full day of their time, plus serving on committees that function all year long. So Blue Cross is well organized, well structured by conscientious, dedicated people. And they do an excellent job, and I was amazed to find out that they were a business organization that took care of the business of the members in a manner that it'd be hard to find a real legitimate criticism about the way they handle the organization for the benefit of its members. And it was for a while that we were becoming computerized, and it took us some time to set up the facilities to handle 650,000 membership claims, so that was a problem, and it took us along about somewhere between 30 days and 5 or 6 weeks to pay off a claim, and that was a little bit long, and now we've got it down to less than a day after we received a claim. It can be processed, and this is due to the computerization of our program.
Oh, we're getting fairly near the end of the tape. Do you have any other thoughts? Can you think of any other anything I haven't asked you that you would like to say?
Well, I would like to see us make a living legend on the story of Blue Cross Blue Shield in Oklahoma. I think there's a story that should be told to the people so that they would better understand the organization of which they are a part. And we are not competing with insurance companies, and they should know this and why. Now, there are some people who drop their Blue Cross Blue Shield and regret it later, because the profit-making organizations cannot handle the health part of the coverage that you'd like to have in the manner that we can handle it, because we just are not interested in making a profit. It isn't possible. There's no one that has a desire to do that. But we want to run a good organization for purposes for which we're organized.
This has been an interview with Dr. Ray Knight of Tulsa, Oklahoma. The date is February the 10th, 1971.